live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect, a time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
You gotta love the music. Gotta love it. I wanted everybody to hear it. Those are the steel pans. I happen to be a steel pan player, believe it or not. And the vibrations that those instruments put out are really quite outstanding. They actually travel up my spine. We might find out a little bit more about that today. We've got a very interesting show. It's a little bit about learning about our future from our past, but it's also about learning about some of the scientific principles that really oversee our whole universe. So we're going to take a diversion. I also want to say I'm glad to be back in the saddle here. Been gone for a couple of weeks doing some genealogy work in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. And it was lovely and came back. And we are 104 degrees, no rain since January down here on the Third Coast. So we might even figure out how to make some rain today. In any event, welcome everybody. Glad to have you with us and glad to have our guest today. You know, one of the things that I've always said is that there is one individual who is probably one of the most phenomenal scientists in the world, who literally said things back in the past that we're all starting to look at a little bit more in the future and you know, for today. And one of these quotes, and I think you'll know who I'm talking about, is really this: nothing will benefit human health and increase the chances for survival of life on Earth as much as the evolution to a vegetarian diet. Now, this came from a scientist. It came from Albert Einstein, who happens to be one of my favorites of all times. So we're going to talk science today, but we're going to talk science in a whole different level with our guest, Bill Donovan. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
A little bit about how you got involved in some of the scientific experiments that has kind of led you on a path to writing your book, Glimpses of Epiphany, One Man's Journey of Discovery. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's, you know, really have a fun hour on a little bit of science, a little bit of spirituality, a little bit of the past. And we will be taking your calls toll-free, 888-815-9756. So hang in there with us. It's going to be a fun hour. So, Bill, how did it start for you?
Oh, well, it actually started in an engineering lab in Chicago, outside of Chicago, and there was this enormous test fixture, which a combination of steel and iron, and there was a small motor that was inside the test fixture, and it had this peculiar vibration to it, and this motor and the entire assembly just slid noiselessly uphill into a wall, and it took three strong guys to pull it back. Well, after that, then I had another motor which started to do the same thing, and I grabbed onto the fixture, and it was the strangest sensation because it almost felt like this 500-pound fixture didn't have a weight to it at all. And I pulled it back, and I could feel the hairs on my arms just stood up while I did that. So there was some kind of electrical component to that too. Although, I mean, the whole fixture was grounded and everything. So after that, the management over there wanted me to do some data mining, which I kind of volunteered to. And this was at the Chicago Public Library. So I would go there, and I would do some data mining for them, looking up a few patents, which didn't take very long, typically about an hour. And it took quite a It took a couple hours to get there by train. So I decided to stay there until the library closed, and I would do my own research on my own nickel. So when I did that, I started to compile patents, and I went down a rabbit hole that was very, very interesting. And I think I mentioned this in my email. It's a wild ride. I saw all of these patents out there, and I've eventually filled up a four-drawer filing cabinet with these things. It was an immense number, and it was an introduction to a world of buried technology that I never knew existed.
Unbelievable. So really what you're saying is that some of the things that have been created by man in time, over time, have been patented but basically never produced.
Right, right. And it's only a small fraction of what is patented that's produced. In fact, both the Chinese, Japanese, and other countries are now mining our patent system to produce the technology that we've basically abandoned.
So what kind of technology is this that you know we abandoned? I mean, you know, we talked about this earlier, you and I, when we were off air. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at Einstein's theory of relativity, and you mentioned to me that it's no longer taught in our school systems, which I didn't know. And,
right.
You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, some of the sci-fi things of 2001, and here we are in 2011, and where are they?
Exactly. What happened to the 21st century? I mean, we should be here, but we're really still living in the 20th.
And, you know, that is so interesting because I never really thought, I mean, you know, technology, on the other hand, our computerized, you know, technology, so to speak, you know, is going by leaps and bounds. I mean, you know, I became a Mac crossover a couple of months ago, and I mean, I just love the stuff that I'm able to do on my Mac mm-hmm. that I couldn't do on my PC. But, you know, I mean, it really is a crutch for us. I mean, you know, we just use our technology more than we use our intuition.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting in that technology really is a tool of the mind, especially computers, so that obviously you have to have a mind to start with to use the tool.
Well, that's true. That is true. And some people never really get the hang of it.
Right, right.
So, but, you know, going back to some of these things, I mean, you know, we hear every day that you know, our universe is made up of energy. Mm-hmm. And we hear every day that every object, everything, every human being is energy. And yet, you know, we're all paying out of the nose for energy to run our cars, energy to, you know, cool our houses in 104 degree heat. And, right. You know, why haven't we bottled up all this energy and used it to help mankind, so to speak?
Right. And I think Arthur C. Clarke was right when he said, and this is kind of an interesting exchange, when they asked Arthur C. Clarke, he envisioned the geosynchronous satellites that we have right now that are in what is now named the Clarke Belt after Arthur C. Clarke. And he predicted a lot of things that came true. But what he didn't, what he missed the mark on, or what we missed the mark on, really, as far as milestones, for example, in 2001, we had orbital hotels, we had bases on the moon, we had probes going to Jupiter. So what happened? And when they asked Arthur C. about this, he said, there's one thing that I didn't count on. He said, I didn't put politics into the equation.
So basically, the political structure in some cases are, you know, really holding us back from what we should, could, and would, you know, would have been.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You know, one of Einstein's, you know, quotes, and, you know, we talked about this too, is, you know, peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved by understanding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say that on my website when we talk about understanding our background, understanding our ancestry. And, you know, by understanding ours and understanding others, you know, we can build an understanding of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just love so much the way he thinks. But
sure.
You know, so we have politics, we have all this stuff going on in the world today, and, you know, it's all force and no understanding. And we have a whole universe of scientific patents that have been produced or people have come up with, but nobody's doing anything with them.
Oh, yes, yes, that is a big problem. In fact, Einstein himself, and this is getting back to what we're discussing off air, was that there was one man who took what was essentially a unified field theory by James Clerk Maxwell, said, oh, we don't need any of those torsion field or tensor components. So he took those parts of the formula, just saw them all, threw them away. Just one man did this, Oliver Heaviside. And then after that, Einstein was trying in vain to try to put gravity back into the equation, trying to put the toothpaste back into the tube. And he really had a hard time doing it. And the rumor has it, in his later years, he did this, and then they gave him a gag order that said, you can't release this, because if you did that, it would be a threat to the power structure.
So basically, the power structure may be the very thing that is holding back, you know, the universe and the growth of the universe. I mean, you know, it's hard to fathom. I mean, you know, you take the experiment or the test that you were doing that defied gravity, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, did you ever figure out what caused that?
Oh, it is. It is. I think it was some kind of a resonance effect on the mass itself. And it turns out that gravity really does have an electrical component to it. This gets into the unified field theory that links electricity, magnetism, and gravity together. So that, for example, with gravity, there is a formula that goes to the effect that, gravity and electricity are opposites of each other. So that if you want an electric field, there's a piece of a gravity field in there. If you want a gravity field, there's a piece of an electric field in there. The two are interrelated to one another.
Well, I mean, all those tornadoes that have been hitting all of us, I mean, it's almost kind of that whole formula.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Oh, there's a great story about that one.
Oh, good. And, let's talk about it.
Okay. So this is coming from one of the Tesla Society symposia that they had back in the 80s, and there was a story about a tornado that was occurring back in the Dust Bowl days. And they noticed that there was a kind of a blue-green fluorescence or ionization to the clouds above the house. And someone knocked a bowl of soup, and it tumbled in slow motion end over end until it hit the wall. Well, after this story, they realized that there was some kind of tremendous electric field that was partially neutralizing the gravitational field. So there was a scientist at one of the major aerospace companies that put a one-pound ball bearing inside of a chamber, inside of a tube, and then around the tube, he had silica sand that was charged up to several thousand volts, and he had approximately 90 psi blowing the sand around, creating an artificial tornado on the inside. When he did this, suddenly the ball bearing would rock from side to side and then suddenly shot out the top of the tube, embedding itself in the ceiling. Well, the aerospace engineer was actually fired for an experiment that they didn't condone. It was a non-official experiment. So after that, I mean, the story went around to several of the symposia. People tried to repeat it, and, you know, they did have some success for some of that. But it shows that there's an electrical component to gravity. In fact, there's a man by the name of Townsend Brown back in the 30s, and we're getting into history again, and he noticed that in a Crookes tube, that's an X-ray tube, that whenever they energized it, there would be a small force that would move the tube to one side. And at first they thought that this was due to just the voltage of the tube. Well, it turned out that wasn't the case, because when Brown started experimenting with capacitors, he noticed that the voltage was actually doing this. So he built different devices, and one called a gravitor that actually would gain or lose weight depending on what the polarization was in this big block of material.
Hey, send me one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where's my hoverboard? I want that. Yeah.
Hey, why don't you patent that idea? That would be wonderful.
Actually, he already did back in the 30s.
Yeah, well, for weight loss, I'm being facetious.
Oh, for the weight loss, right.
Yeah. I'm being facetious. I don't know. Yeah. I'm in a crazy mood today, so what can I say?
So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Oh, okay. So anyway, the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, is that now going forward a couple of decades, Brown worked on this thing for a long, long time, and everybody said, oh, let's do it in one ion wind. It's an ion effect. So he built a saucer-shaped model, put it in a vacuum chamber, and the thing lifted off. Well, he had a general come in to see this thing. When the general saw this, they immediately classified the project. So it's interesting in that, and there are references that you can Google that's called the Biefield Brown effect. That's Biefeld or Biefield Brown, Brown. And that's Thomas Townsend Brown. And this guy, I mean, this is the real deal. This guy did a lot of work on this. So, in fact, I mean, there is rumor that the B-1 bomber that we have now actually has a high voltage component to its design to reduce the drag coefficient of the plane itself. So it's got an anti-gravity system built in a way. I mean, it's not real. I mean, it's not hovering or anything, but it's a way of reducing the drag coefficient of the airframe.
So really what you're saying, and I am not a scientist, and we talked about this. I don't think on that side of my brain at all. If there is a electrical component to gravity, and since
right.
our Earth is built on gravity,
mm-hmm.
then there is an electrical charge or electrical component to everything in our space.
Yes.
That
yes.
is creating, quote, energy.
Yes.
So one could theoretically say, if one wanted to stick their neck out on the line, that there's a lot of energy that exists just in our everyday world, you know, that really, and I say bottled up, but, you know, I mean, could this energy be used for our own benefit? I mean, I don't know about the rest of this of y'all, but, you know, my energy bills in this house keep going up and up and up and up and up, and I keep bringing it down, 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 down. And, you know, I feel like almost all of my income seems to be going towards fueling something.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. And, I mean, we're living in a society where we have energy that's rationed, where we have raw materials and different items rationed to us, essentially by using economic principles to do that. In fact, well, look at Enron, for example. I mean, Enron basically didn't generate 1 watt of electricity. They would just buy electricity at a cheap rate and then jack it up and then resell it. I mean, that's how they were making their money. But getting back to the question about, well, how much energy do we have out there? There was a man by the name of Shinichi Seki that estimated that there's 10 to the 93rd to 10 to the 103rd, a big exponent, of ergs per cubic centimeter. Well, how big is this? Well, 10 to the 93rd ergs is big enough, using equals mc squared that Einstein had in his equation, that it's large enough that one cubic centimeter has enough energy in it to boil off all of the Earth's oceans. That's how much energy is there in the vacuum.
Wow. Well, it's doing it here.
Slowly.
Yeah, I guess we're living it. We got a lot of energy here with the heat and the, you know, it's crazy. But so really what you're saying, and you know, maybe we can break this down a little bit,
sure,
is that there is enough energy produced by us, gravity, and anything that's existing in this earth plane, mm-hmm, that could very easily take care of our energy needs to keep our cars on the road and keep our houses warm in the winter and cool in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so how does one, you know, I mean, it's all really part of the whole green energy, the whole green
right
thing is, you know, how do we tap into this?
Well, there's different ways of doing it. There are mechanical methods. There's thermal methods. There are solid state methods to do this. For example, there are a couple patents. One is by Frank Richardson back in 1977 that actually uses a pair of permanent magnets and what he calls a flux switch to accomplish that. Now, as long as it takes less energy to run the switch, then you're getting out of the whole process, then you have an amplification factor going on. That's one of them. There's something called the Alessi-Rossi process. And it turns out that cold fusion was real after all. I mean, it's been verified in several laboratories all over the planet. And there's something strange about this fusion effect, because they're actually getting more energy out than can be accounted for by the fusion process. So there's some kind of interaction with the vacuum, and now they're starting to recognize that. So cold fusion actually might be an interim way of finding out how to directly tap this vacuum energy. But that's real. I mean, they're actually talking about building a 1 megawatt fusion reactor in Italy based on this process.
And compare that for me, because, like I said, I don't think in any terms of watts or anything else like that. I have to, if I need to go buy something, I have to have somebody explain to me what I'm buying when it comes to electrical anything.
Oh, sure. A 1 megawatt power plant would be about as much as a small hydroelectric plant. So it would be enough to run a small town, for example.
Wow.
So,
and
yes.
What does it take to build a plant like this? I mean,
In that case, what they were doing, what they intend on doing is it uses they call it the ECAT, and that means that it's a catalytic fusion system based really on transmutation. And there was a man earlier this is going all the way back in the turn of the century, where they're talking about catalytically changing different metals into other metals. This gets into irradiating different materials with neutrons, for example.
Hmm.
And they realized, yeah, that would work, but it would take too much energy. But then afterwards, when they started splitting the atom, found out that that had a lot of energy, then we went toward the fission route, which really was the wrong way to go. I think the Japanese figured that one out.
Yes. They did, big time.
Oh, yeah. And then there's, of course, fusion, which is what the sun is using. And it's safe for the most part, unless you're near a star that goes supernova, which is also bad news. But as far as vacuum energy goes, which is way, way beyond fission and fusion, once you get to vacuum energy, then, I mean, you're at the point where you can pull enough energy out of the vacuum to restructure the vacuum. Now, we know that matter itself is a hologram. I mean, that's something that we also discovered over the years. So if you can restructure matter or materialize matter with enough energy, it's a reverse part of the E=mc², where you have enough energy to create matter. If you can do that, that means that the replicator that Star Trek has, for example, is possible. That means that with enough energy, you can create whatever you wanted. Now, what this means is that you're going to have a different type of economy. Instead of an economy based on scarcity, based on rationing of different substances and different materials and energy, now you have an infinite number of amount of energy. You have an infinite amount of whatever you want. So the only scarce commodity that's out there now
are politicians.
Well, hopefully, yeah. Yeah, maybe we'll put them out of a job, too.
But, I couldn't help myself. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but, I mean, the only other thing really is ideas. I mean, it's human thought. We can't replicate that.
No. Amazing. It is amazing. And, I mean, you know, here we are, you know, going out and making messes of our environment. I mean, you know, the thing that happened down in the Gulf, you know, last year that, right. You know, just hurt my soul being from New Orleans. You know, and we're doing that in place of doing what you're talking about. And I guess, you know, I don't understand it. And I don't, you know, accept that it's all based on economics and it's all based on capitalism, more or less.
Right. Right. I mean, there's so much of our energy policy that's wrapped up in the economics. And, I mean, really, at this type, and they call it free energy, but this type of free energy has been suppressed for over a century. And it's been said that the only thing that you can't kill is a good idea. And, I mean, they have been... Excuse me.
Sure.
Okay. They have been suppressing this for a long time through just burying patents, buying up patents and shelving them. That's another thing.
And is that what you found when you started going through and doing this whole patent research? Is that were they, you know, bought and resold and shelved?
Yes, in some cases what they would do is they would buy up the patents and then shelve them. I mean, that's pretty common. So you see some of that, and there's been just so much apathy for alternative energy, and I think that if anything good can come out of what happened with the Gulf and what happened at the Fukushima plant, then I think what we're going to see is that there's going to be a change in consciousness.
Well, there is. It just hasn't reached the lawmakers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that the people of this country are beginning to change their end. I mean, I know I am doing my best to not use near as much energy as I used in previous years. I, you know, very careful about where I drive. I'm very careful about keeping the house at a temperature that is livable but not, you know, really mm-hmm. cool, really cool. You know, I use a pool to keep me cool. But I think a lot of people are doing that. And, you know, I mean, the electric part of the whole car system of, you know, buying these electric cars, if the energy that you plug it into is not, quote unquote, you know, free, green, clear, then what's the point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's an excellent point. So that, I mean, if you have a hydro plant, that's one thing. But, I mean, if you're plugging it into a coal-fired power plant, well, I mean, I mean, you're not really doing anything green.
Right. So, I mean, you really, what you're saying is if there was a way to, you know, bottle up, I guess, this vacuum that you're talking about, mm-hmm. that could be put into some sort of thing like a generator of sorts.
Yes, yes. And
that could then, you know, begin to power both, you know, the vehicles and the houses and whatever, and be using clean energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
but imagine the kind of economy that would result in that, because right now, and this is interesting, that 2/3 of the serviceable debt is coming from oil, from foreign oil.
Right.
I mean, out of the trillions of dollars that the U.S. has in their debt, it's coming from foreign oil. So if we got rid of foreign oil, if we went with an alternative energy technology based either on fusion, vacuum energy, something clean, I mean, even geothermal, that means that we're getting rid of that part of the debt.
And?
And, I mean,
why are we not doing this?
Because the people that are running the show want us to stay on oil.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, why aren't they? I mean, I don't know about where everybody else lives, but I know that there's a couple of areas there where I go that's a little bit south of here where they have wind farms now.
Right.
And I know that part of my energy plan that I pay for is, you know, 10 or 20% wind energy today.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't know how long it's going to take for that wind energy, you know, I mean, that energy plan to become more and more based on you know, clean energy.
Right. Right. Especially since, I mean, what's happening right now with our grid is that it needs a $4 trillion shot in the arm because it's falling apart. I mean, it's because it's falling apart, a lot of these wind farms are only running at partial capacity.
Or you're a busy guy.
Yeah, yeah. It never rings until now.
Yeah. I turn mine off, but I'm used to doing this.
Yeah.
I've missed it once or twice, but I normally turn mine off. So, you know, and you know, you bring this up. I mean, I thought it was very interesting. I was watching Steve Jobs, you know, present his plan for his new, you know, building. And what he told the city council was, you know, he's planning to power his whole facility on his own and use the grid as his backup power rather than vice versa, which I thought was very intriguing.
Yes, yes. That is another possibility. Is instead of using the grip, oh, sorry about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll just leave it off the hook. So, anyway.
So, you know, I mean, so there are people that are thinking about this, and, you know, and apparently they're planning to build some sort of clean energy facility,
mm-hmm.
To power that. You know, space-looking building. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's pretty outrageous. But, you know, leave it to Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not even pulling off the grid pattern for their energy. I just thought that was interesting now that you brought that up. Not that I'm an energy fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we do have, you know, alternatives, I guess, is what
yes.
you're really saying. And these alternatives are apparently not being embraced by our society.
Oh, sure. And there's another one, and this is a little more conventional. And this came out around 1980. It's The High Frontier by Gerard K. O'Neill and Colonies in Space by T.A. Heppenheimer talked about geosynchronous solar power satellites. And at that time, it would have cost, oh, perhaps about $1 billion to put one of these up. At that time, a lot of money. But it would have beamed power directly to the ground. And with one of those satellites, just one satellite would be enough to run the entire country. Now, if you had a network of these things in geosync orbit, that means that the entire planet would be running on solar energy. And up there, the sun shines 24/7.
Yeah, they're what, at one of the poles.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, is also another interesting thing. You have, you know, I think one pole at one season, one pole at another season. You put two of them up, and lo and behold, look at what you got.
Right, right.
Interesting. It really is. It's fascinating, Bill, and it's just so fascinating that some of this has really been in the pipeline for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Historically. It has been. Historically. That, you know, our ancestors actually came up with some of these brilliant ideas that even got patented and, you know, have been sitting in the wings. And, you know, because they were obviously looking for better lives for all of us and thinking about how to make things better. And you know, they just went into your four-box file cabinet.
Right, right. I mean, there are literally hundreds of patents out there on this. There are some other patents as well that, well, other than magnetic energy, in the case of Frank Richardson, there are some that actually use electrical energy. Now, one, of course, which was documented, by the way, is the case of the ML converter of the Maternita community in Switzerland. And they're using a device that extracts energy, again, out of the evidently out of the vacuum. And they're powering a community with it. And this is interesting. The reason that they didn't want to release this to the rest of the world is because they said that the world really wasn't spiritually advanced enough to handle the concept.
So are you saying that those of us, I guess, that think a little bit more on the spiritual side, and look at the scientists. I mean, look at Albert Einstein. I mean, all these mm-hmm. scientists, you know, really left brain spiritualist, I guess is what you want to call it. I mean, they've always said that they kind of you know, were into the mysterious and trying to solve you know, the mystery of the universe. I mean, we do live in a mysterious place.
Oh, sure.
That is what is more mysterious. To me, is how we could have all these things available to us and, you know, just literally shove them into closets and, you know, set ourselves up for, you know, a planet that, you know, cannot survive and support our descendants. I mean, this is scary.
Right, right. It's all about choices. And I think what's happening is that we've been letting the wrong people make the choices for us.
Well, that's obviously true.
Yeah. It's about time that, I mean, as a grassroots movement, we collectively make the right choices.
Because, I mean, you know, going back to this whole 2012 theory,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I mean, we really are in a place where we do have to start to flex our muscles a little bit and ask for and demand alternatives to what has, you know, obviously been forced down our throats for many, many years since the beginning of this whole energy movement.
The last
movement.
Century.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really is this last century. And I mean, if you looked at it from a historical point of view, from a genealogical point of view, you have, you know, the Einsteins of the world, you know, who mm-hmm. were thinking along these lines. I don't know when these patents that you know, you're talking about, you know, were put in. So, you know, are we talking about from the 50s on, from the 40s on? I mean, What generation started this whole transformation?
Back in the 1890s. 1890s were an interesting time because everyone thought anything was possible. That science was going to be It's going to provide for a utopia for the Earth. And, you know, it might have, but it didn't because politics got in the way.
Mm-hmm. So really, you know, if you go back to the turn of the century, and interestingly enough, I mean, I don't know how many of you, I had a grandmother that was born right around the turn of the century, and when she passed away in the late 80s, you know, we would talk about, you know, the fact that she grew up during the horse and buggy days, mm-hmm. and she lived far past the you know, into the, you know, landing on the moon and all of this, you know, and the computer movement and the PC movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to look at people who actually live through that change in the environment at that level and think, my goodness, I mean, you know, we, you know, even those of us who are born at the turn, you know, at the mid-century point, mm-hmm. You know, haven't seen that really a diverse, you know, change in technology and change in science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've seen a lot, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But not that, not from horse and buggy to where we are today.
And it's interesting when you go back into the history of a lot of the technology. For example, in the turn of the century, I mean, we had the Stanley steamer, the electric car, and then we had another vehicle that was unreliable and tended to explode on occasion, which was a gasoline engine. Well,
and which one did we choose?
We chose the one that blew up. So, I mean, it took a major amount of propaganda to just convince people that the gasoline engine was the way to go. But back at that time, we had the electric car, and it was working, and it was popular. So they had to change the mindset away from an electric car back to the gasoline engine. And the brainwashing has been so well done and so pervasive that now they're trying to change it back to the electric vehicle, and it's almost impossible. Now we have to have a hybrid car because nobody believes an electric car will work.
Yeah,
it's a big problem.
It really is kind of funny. I mean, I have to, you know, say that I guess we did miss a few beats along the way.
Yeah. And oh, the interesting part about gasoline as well is that at that time, gasoline was a waste byproduct of the refining process. They had to find a way of getting rid of it. That's why they promoted the gasoline engine. In other words, they had something that they had to find a market for to get rid of it. So they supported the gasoline engine. So now, so we have something that's really what was a waste byproduct of the refining process, and we're paying through the nose for this fuel that really was just garbage.
Well, it doesn't say a whole lot.
No, it doesn't.
If anybody has any questions or wants to add some of their sense to what I'm starting to feel is a little nonsense, please give us a call, 888-815-9756. So really going back to the turn of the century and mm-hmm. to the 1890s, there were a lot of technology that literally never got introduced to the public.
Right, right.
And we went down some of these pretty much bad roads.
Right, we went down the wrong fork in the road.
and you know, there's really no going back. I don't know how many gas guzzling cars that we have on the roads today. But, you know, how do you, you know, literally pick all those things up and trash them and start over again? You can't. So yeah, we really have, you know, put ourselves in an interesting box.
Yeah, it takes about 20 years for a new energy source to take over. In other words, when we burn coal, and they discovered petroleum. It took 20 years to convert over from that, but it wasn't a complete conversion. We still have coal furnaces out there. We still have coal-fired power plants. So you can introduce a new form of energy, but that doesn't obsolete the old form. It's still around for a long, long time. People are still burning wood, and they have been for thousands of years. So, I mean, that's another way to look at it.
So, really, what you're saying is that there are many, many, many different opportunities for us to, as human beings on this planet, to look at alternative energy.
Sure.
And there are patents that have existed upwards of 30, 40, 50 years.
Up to 100 years, yeah.
100 years that have literally sat in closets.
Right.
Or file folders and never saw the light of day. And we've got a community and of people who are struggling and medically, financially, because of the high prices that have been put on this energy. And, you know, I guess which and then really what you're saying is the only way that we can change this is for everybody to band together and, you know, start making demands. I mean, what does it take to get, you know, this information out to the public?
Actually, the information pretty much is already out there. If anybody has access to the internet, they have access to this information.
But it's not getting to mainstream.
Oh, the mainstream. Oh, the mainstream media has access to it. They just decided that, along with there's a kind of a hidden agenda along with all this. So they're not interested in promoting it. It's got to come from the people. And it has to come from the people individually. That means that every one of us has to educate ourselves on what's going on. We can't be spoon-fed information, because you can't trust the one who's holding the spoon.
Well, I have something else awful to say about that, but I think I will.
Okay.
I don't even think I want to go there.
Well, as far as books go, I mean, there's one called The Coming Energy Revolution by Jeannie Manning. There's a lot of books out there. There's a lot of websites out there. One is the Rex Research site, rexresearch.com. And there's several different organizations out there that are also doing this. The U.S. Psychotronics Association has some archives going way, way back on their speakers that presented alternative energy and free energy information. Anybody who has access to a computer can Google anything by Tom Bearden or Henry Moray. Henry Moray also had a device back in the 30s and 40s that produced 50,000 watts. That was the size of a shoebox back in the 30s and 40s. So...
So, relatively speaking, I mean, how much does it take to run an average house? How many watts of power? I don't have clues about this kind of stuff.
On the average, I think if you had a generator that probably, a small generator that would produce about 5,000 watts charging a battery rack. And by generator, I don't mean something running on a fossil fuel system, but either on there's something called the water gas approach to free energy, and that's hydrogen, by the way. Whenever somebody sees water gas, that means hydrogen. Water gas was called hydrogen back in the turn of the century, or the other way around, really.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, when they had some of the gas lights that were lit by water gas, that was hydrogen. I mean, we're using hydrogen way back then. So, as far as the amount of 5,000-watt generator would probably do it. Probably if you wanted to do away with the battery rack, something that has an overload capacity of about 20,000 watts, that would do it. Again, with more wattage, when you get into mechanical systems, it starts to get pretty pricey. So any kind of solid-state system would be preferable.
So basically, with this little box that you're talking about, mm-hmm. you know, you could have run 10 houses or a block off of a box.
Yes. Conservatively, yes. So that little box of Henry Morais could run an entire block of houses.
So the other concept, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm just, you know, flying off today in one of my... But what if we could find one of these boxes, or somebody made one of these boxes, and you get together with your neighbors and you buy one,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, you know, you can tell your energy company to go take a...
You're going to tell them to do something else with their power, yeah.
No, seriously, I mean, would this be one way that the people could literally take some action?
Yes, it's got to be at the grassroots. And I know that there's going to be a lot of opposition politically. I mean, there's going to be people saying, oh, you can't do that because the zoning requirements say that, I mean, only solar energy is available or that sort of thing. There's going to, I mean, so the zoning requirements are going to have to be changed, or the building codes are going to have to change to allow this. I mean, to show you how absurd this is, they're actually talking about putting miniature nuclear reactors, I mean, fission reactors inside of homes. I mean, that's not a good idea at all. But as long as you had a free energy system, which is not fission, obviously, the argument could be made that some of the cold fusion stuff is actually tapping the vacuum. But if you had one of these things and it's safe and you can prove that it won't overload and turn your home into a smoking hole in the ground, then yes, I mean, there shouldn't be any opposition. As long as it didn't become a smoking hole in the ground.
Right. So really what you're saying is even if we tried to take some of these things into our own hands, that we would be thwarted.
Oh, there would definitely be resistance going on because right now, I mean, you have a multi-trillion dollar set of industries between commercial power that's out there and the petroleum companies and the energy suppliers are in bed with the power companies. So, I mean, you're really taking on both of those at the same time. So, yeah, there would be resistance politically, for sure.
So the other option would be to try to encourage, quote-unquote, the power companies to begin to provide us with efficient, low-cost, green energy.
Which is against their interest because they want to extract resources from us in the process. So, I mean, it's going to be, I mean, no matter what the way you look at it, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Or you could go buy some land out in the country and do whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah, then nobody would care if you had a small free energy generator and just you would heat and light your house and people would wonder why you're not burning wood or burning petroleum.
You know, you've really got me going on this. I haven't really thought about these things at the level that you brought it up to me prior to the show and now during the show as to, you know, the fact that, you know, we're on a collision course and, you know, without making some drastic changes or forcing some drastic changes that, you know, this whole concept that we're trying to live under as spiritual beings, you know, understanding that we have and produce energy, as does everything else, and that, you know, we should at some point think a little bit more, we should be thinking about how to bottle this clean, free energy that we create up into something that, that could be used, you know, that would not spoil our environment.
Right, right. And you would think that environmentalists would be the first to jump on the bandwagon for this, but, I mean, a lot of them aren't. And it's interesting that they're not. It's very telling as far as who's really running the environmental movement. I remember that there were a few people earlier, Tom Bearden being one of them, who tried to get environmentalists interested in this. And after he said that there were some environmentalists who actually were being funded by the petroleum industry, which was interesting, but kind of like the controlled opposition sort of thing. And after that, I think he was very disheartened over the whole situation. But, yeah, well, you know, it's the old adage, follow the money. I mean, if you think your environmental, your local environmentalist really cares about the environment, you know, just ask him about a few of these things and see what he says.
Well, it, you know, it almost sounds like an impossible task. And you know, so, I mean, the kind of work that you're doing is really important, and it's important that people hear about these things in a way that, you know, I mean, you're just a you're a researcher, right?
Right, right. That's pretty much what I am.
And I mean, you know, you're not building anything, you're not making anything. I mean, you know, if I was putting you on the stand, I mean, you're not going to make millions of dollars off of some patent that you have.
Yeah.
I mean, we're really just talking straight research on, you know, what we can do as people to, you know, protect the environment and protect our lives.
Yes, yes,
you know,
definitely.
And to protect the lives of our children and our children's children.
Yes.
And from the genealogist's point of view, I mean, that's, you know, if our ancestors hadn't protected to the best of their ability, based on when they lived, we wouldn't be here. So,
right,
you know,
you could say that what I'm doing is genealogy and technology, and finding out where it's leading back to. And it's been kind of like Alice in Wonderland, and going down the rabbit hole.
I can imagine, because I mean, I can see the thwart at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to know that it exists, to know that it's out there, to know that, you know, we missed opportunities. And, you know, when we live our lives and you know, we talk about this, and I talk about this in, you know, some of the classes that I teach, it's the stories, you know, that it's the lessons that we learn from the stories that our ancestors tell us. And really what's going on here is that it's the lessons of the stories of the science,
yes,
that you're giving out, that we really need to learn the lessons, drop the stories, forget the fact that it didn't go the way it should have gone.
Mm-hmm.
But what can we do about it today? How can we make it a change for us today?
Fortunately, all that documentation still exists. So you can still go back there and see and take a look at the road that we didn't take and just
learn the lesson.
Right, right, exactly.
And by learning that lesson, then we have a better way of being able to understand a better way to move forward, which, you know, like I said, I mean, I've never really delved into this whole thing until you and I started talking. And you know, what I'm seeing is not a very pretty picture on any way, shape, or form. But, you know, we have some lessons to be learned.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some stories that you know, are very easily being portrayed. And, you know, if we can learn from these lessons and to be able to make, you know, apply what we've learned to make it better for the future generations, then, you know, that's really what we're tasked to do today.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And what you're doing is great. Tell us a little bit about your book. I know we're getting kind of close to the end of the hour, but...
Oh, sure, sure.
I don't think we have anybody after us, so let's give it a whirl.
All right. The Glimpses of Epiphany book, that's essentially, it's my journey down the rabbit hole.
And now, is this book available?
It's self-published.
And, okay.
I just brew them up as I need them.
Okay. So, I mean, is there a place that they can order? Do you have an email address if anybody's interested?
Oh, sure. I have an email address. That's William Donovan that's Donavan at Windstream, WINDSTREAM.net. And I think at the moment I was selling them for $19.95. That's a little bit over cost. But like I said, they're GBC bound, and it's not perfect bound or anything, but it's just self-published. As far as the content goes, there's some research that I did, and it's a big chunk of the book, about a third of it, about the Kosky-Frost experiment of 1927. And I probably should go into that one. I was looking for the real deal for anti-gravity, and I knew that Brown had something, but there was a rumor, and this is from Andrew Makrowski of Pace, that a guy by the name of Jerry Gallimore wrote an article on this thing, and this was when he went to Germany and was told during a conference over there that there was another experiment that was done at a Derrdean laboratory in Poland back in 1927, where they piezoelectrically overcharged a quartz crystal. And after they did this, they put it into a field where they bombarded it with radio frequency energy, and the thing just lifted off. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it's hovering over your bench, that's real anti-gravity.
There you go.
So they actually started putting dead weights on this thing to find out how much the thing can lift. And it kind of sounds like the hoverboard from Back to the Future, too. Maybe that's what we're going to use it for, but I don't know. But it could lift up to 800 times its own weight.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Jerry Gallimore, after that, in 1980, repeated the experiment. And he also put a couple patents out calling this stuff a deflexion crystal. And there's documentation for that in the USPA, that's the U.S. Psychotronics Association, as well as the Planetary Association for Clean Energy, run by Andrew Makrowski. It's one of the articles in his journal. So in that one, he shows how if you treat this crystal the right way, you can put electromagnetic energy in, and what comes out is gravitational energy. It's like a transducer.
Hmm.
I mean, this is like the tractor beam from Star Trek.
I can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's 1927 is when this thing was done. That's what's so amazing about it. It really is true that, I mean, in order to see the future, you have to look into the past.
Right. And I'm a strong proponent of that, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really am. Well, Bill, I think this has been delightful. It has been really educational for me because it's something that I've not really delved into at this kind of level. As I mentioned, I think that you know, it's a lot more nonsense than it is sense to me about, you know, how we got to where we are. And I guess that, you know, I'm going to do some more reading personally because I really think that it's important that, you know, we try to affect some changes in our environment. And hopefully we can do so with free and clear energy. I'm just really baffled. I mean, I'm baffled about the whole topic. It just really blows me away. So I thank you for coming and sharing that time with me and sharing
thank
this
you,
with the audience, because I really think that we all need to open our eyes just a little bit more to where we are and where we need to go and where we have been going. And if there are any lessons to be learned, we need to learn them fast, and we need to see what we all can do, both individually and collectively, to make some changes.
Definitely.
And moving forward, this may be part of our 2012 journey, huh?
One can only hope.
Yep. Bill, thanks again. We will see you all next Tuesday. This is Susan King. Have a wonderful week.
You have been listening to Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect with Susan E. King. Each week we will focus on the spiritual journey of connecting ourselves with our ancestors. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. For upcoming show information, you can visit Susan's website at www.susaneking.com.